Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody except Nick Osello and Larkin Kemp. Nick, because he cost us 15 minutes to get this thing going, and Larkin, because he's the reason. I am not currently drinking a Guinness because he chirped me about trying to get my run in before we got started. Now, in his defense, I asked to postpone the start of this recording, and I definitely did what I always do, which was undersell how long it was going to get delayed. So kudos to you, Larkin, for seeing through that one right away.
Yeah, appreciate that. You can always count on Nick Osello for a 15-minute delay.
Guys, Larkin, I got nothing either. I've blown it. I don't have my notes up. It's going to be a little bit ad hoc today. But luckily, that's where we thrive. I mean, if there was anybody that would have fit in 2016 Browns, run and gun, you don't really have a plan other than put your foot on the gas, it's me. So I don't want to hear anything until the end of the episode where we can debrief how bad my performance was.
Nick, you hopefully everybody just watched your call of the Seals game on the U after North Carolina versus Jacksonville. And Larkin, hopefully by the time people are listening to this, congratulations are in order for the Lady Cardinal, who are hosting Yale in a big, what is it? It's not top five, but it is a top 10 matchup in women's lacrosse.
It's top five women's RPI. So
there you go.
Seeding and tournament implications. This is a huge matchup and two schools that really don't like each other. And if anyone needs a quick refresher, I literally hate Yale. So I barely slept. I was out of bed, ready to roll. So let's go.
Larkin, is that your least favorite team of all? Is it Yale that dominates the Kemp hatred report?
Yeah, they have the most headspace. I mean, they flipped my brother in the middle of the night. So, yeah, it's all day. They got real estate for sure.
With respect to the Tailgate podcast, the staggered start to league play makes the stakes kind of equivalently staggered. I mean, we've already got, you know, Patriot League teams that have played two or three games, and we've got, you know, Big Ten and ACC teams that have yet to play a conference opponent. I would say, as a result, it might make sense to talk a little bit in terms of trends. It feels like scoring is inching up as the year goes along after, I think, some low-scoring results kind of kick things off. And overall, I don't know if I actually believe this. I've got some anti-COVID year of eligibility voices in my DMs who have spent the last 3 years talking about how it ruined college sports. And are claiming that this year the results are already more narrow, which might be true, but I also think that that might be a reflection of some of the conference play getting underway. All in all, I think this was a week in which there were a lot of games that need to be discussed, fewer kind of preeminent marquee games, so I think we're just going to go a little shorter on more games. How do you guys feel about that?
I feel like it's a good recentering opportunity to be like, we've gone in depth into a lot of the games. Maybe let's take a step back, view it from a little bit higher up, see which teams are trending up, see which teams, Brown, are trending down, and we can go from there. So I love the idea, Terry.
No comment. Ready to roll.
Before we get started, the men's and women's NCAA championship weekends are heading back to Gillette Stadium, held jointly for the first time since 2017. From May 23rd to May 26th, there's nowhere else in the lacrosse world to be other than Foxborough, Massachusetts, for 8 of the best and most impactful games of the season. The action starts Friday with the women's D1 semis, continues Saturday with the men's D1 semis, and then the championship action starts on Sunday with men's Division 2, men's Division 3, and women's Division 1, culminating Monday afternoon with the men's D1 final. Shout out to Phil Buttafuoco, who is a longtime employee of Gillette Stadium and the New England Patriots, who just recently rejoined the world of college athletics. He's going to be a part of the Army Black Knights front office. So really exciting there. We'll miss him when it comes to hosting this event. Nick, I got to get you a new point of contact for that suite that you inquired about a couple weeks ago.
Yep. I was just going to say I've never met him, but boy, does that name align with an email that you sent me. So we'll touch base on that offline.
This year, Inside Lacrosse is proud to partner with the NCAA to offer you, our loyal listeners, $5 off all single game ticket options. Nick, you're probably going to need to use this given the aforementioned email bounce back. Using code ILPOD at checkout. So head to ncaa.com/laxtickets and enter ILPOD at checkout to purchase your tickets. You know you're going to be there. Why not get $5 off and help us show the NCAA how awesome our loyal listeners are by purchasing your tickets today. Once again, ncaa.com/laxtickets and iPod at checkout. Nick, does your inability to see your notes mean that I am on the click stick and hosting us?
If you give me, I think it would almost be a funny exercise if you gave me the game and I can see how much I remembered from the notes.
Perfect.
And then you fill in the blanks and then we go from there.
We're going to start with Cornell versus Princeton.
Cornell versus Princeton. What an unbelievable game. CJ Kearse goes for 5 and becomes Cornell's all-time leading scorer, passing Mike French, who also was in attendance and was interviewed, I think, by someone at Inside Lacrosse. It might have been you, Terry Foy.
Yeah, I called
him. And Mike French just had unbelievable things to say about CJ Kearse. Not only a great ball player, but a great human being. Cornell, in various moments, jumped out to leads. Princeton was able to come back and make it interesting, ultimately, before Cornell won
15-10
by a final score of 15-10. What interested me the most about this game, and we can start here, was Cornell's defense's ability to hold Princeton to just 10 goals. Princeton, a lot of horsepower, a lot of firepower, and really the big takeaway for me was Cornell's ability to get momentum and to make slide decisions difficult. When they're getting momentum and dodging towards their man, they're not really going down the alley or going to the middle. They're making moves and shooting with pressure, finding skip passes with pressure, and overall making it a difficult day for Princeton's D. But Cornell's defense did a great job kind of jamming up those very skip passes we saw Cornell execute on and putting on so much pressure that Princeton couldn't really find a rhythm. Big win for the Big Red. Number 6 takes down number 2. And CJ Kearse, low to high. It's not the prettiest thing, but it's like the difference between a cannon and a sniper rifle. He has an absolute cannon, and it's fun to watch. Terry, Cornell beats Princeton.
I'm going to give this one to Larkin because I think his point actually aligns more closely to yours.
So these are two teams I watch a lot of, and I really did believe that there was no path towards an outcome in which Princeton doesn't score 14 to 16 goals. Like, heading into the matchup, I thought, based on Cornell losing and the way they lost to Penn State, I thought they'd have that kind of circle the wagons mojo game in which they win maybe 17-15. So I think the three takeaways for me was I wanted to get eyes on the Princeton goaltender against a better offense and see how he moves, because I think he's a differentiator if he's as good as his statistics the first few weeks imply. I thought he was moving okay. I did not think he was a world beater just based on the eye test, irrelevant to statistics. And I thought that Cornell's defense and Jordan Stevens did a little bit more to elevate their slide decisions and hedge recovery. Like basically they made it harder for Mackesy and Kabiri. And ultimately, as we all know, the path to winning 4 games in May and ultimately dogpiling, it comes from the back end, and especially at a non-traditional blue blood school. Like, for Cornell to win and to beat Maryland, you know, they got to engage in a John Tillman level rock fight. And I thought it was a huge weekend for Cornell. And ultimately, the one seed this year in the Ivy tournament will mean more than most years, because I think the middle of the Ivy table is down. So that four seed game could be a layup.
Larkin, what do you look for eye test wise with goalies?
So for me, it's like lateral movement, and then it's hand guessing. So I basically use my hockey eyes. Like, ultimately, when you're watching hockey warmups, you can kind of tell if a goalie's really into it based on the way he's moving east west and responding to one timers. And that is how I judge a lacrosse goalie. So ultimately, 6x6, the net's ginormous. It's literally an ocean. We're going to fill it up today, lady card. But you basically want to see how quick the hands are to get in there.
The thing I was watching for this game was a little bit, I don't want to call it bigger picture, but at the same time, Princeton's still number one in the RPI. You made the point, this is going to position Cornell very nicely to host the Ivy League tournament. So I don't want to say the stakes of this game were null, because they weren't, but they were pretty limited because both these teams have done so much work already to establish themselves for who they are. Part of me wanted to see how Cornell responded to a loss and really having played poorly 3 games in a row, or at least in stretches of 3 games. And so in those ways, I was encouraged. But from a trend standpoint that I think, you know, if we're playing one of those ESPN games, like, does it matter or does it not matter? The trend that I'm interested in is Princeton facing off. Matt Kinnear wrote the story before the season, basically pointing out that Princeton has not been good facing off, I mean, ever, really? Like, but certainly in the Chris Bates, Matt Madelon era. And it looked as if Andrew McMeekin was going to rectify that, given the performance that he put in 2024. He went 10 for 22, which is 45%. So I'm not, like, ringing the alarm bell on the basis of this game. And not only that, but also I think Jack Haskadden is a potential teamer All-American who kind of escaped the consciousness a little bit because he missed all of last year due to injury. That being said, Andrew McMeekin is still at 37%. And I don't want to be overly influenced by the voices in my DMs, having already referenced them once in the first 10 and a half minutes of this show, but I had a different voice who was a D1 faceoff dad who watched Princeton in the fall and raised the alarm that Andrew McMeekin might be a little bit more subject to the new faceoff rules, you know, kind of undermining some of the things that he did well relative to some of the rest of the field. And if that's what that 37% is meant to indicate, then this doesn't feel like a, you know, six-game blip that has the opportunity to get rectified. It feels like a, you know, kind of fundamental undermining of his approach to the position and what it means going forward. So I am well established on this podcast as not being a savvy enough face-off evaluator to know. I've already conceded that I thought that the putting the ball down after the players took the position and the two referees was going to be a bigger change. And every faceoff guy has since told me that no, it's the staggering of the cadence that matters more. And if it's the staggering of the cadence that matters more, and McMeekin was a really effective guesser, and that's what's contributing to the 37% for so far this season, then yeah, I think it's cause for concern going forward.
Final point, I feel like Cornell's roles on offense are beautifully defined. And you kind of saw in the first half a great shift of, hey, we're going to initiate with the guys who can move the ball, and then we're going to look for Firth, who moves beautifully off ball. The submarine cuts were so effective that they had a couple, you know, just pass to the backside, quick sticks in. And then when Princeton addressed that, we really got to see the horses run for Cornell. So it's a difficult team to game plan against. And that was a big takeaway for me, was Princeton's offense was kind of shut down with early slides and kind of making sure that the individual performances didn't beat them, whereas Cornell kind of had a two-faced offense, one that was feeding to the backside and scoring versus we have some horses and they're just going to be able to score no matter what. So kind of an interesting schematic matchup for any defense that has to respect the individual performance, but will be giving up those backside passes. So, and CJ Curse is just fun to watch, man. He's just, you know, give him a full head of steam.
Does he have the highest approval rating in the history of the sport? I don't know anybody who doesn't like it. I mean, throw out any other name of somebody that you think is pretty universally liked. I guarantee you I can call something out that people didn't like about that guy's game or approach.
Yeah, it's a very unique story, but he's almost made it likable to go to an Ivy League school, which is crazy. Like, I don't know if he's getting this love if he's at Princeton.
Something well, and again, credit to his brothers as well. You know, you meet any of the Curse brothers, you meet anybody in the Curse family, and you just walk away going like, wow, that was one of the nicest, most genuine people I've ever met in my entire life. So,
Steele Stanwyck have a higher approval rating than
That's CJ. A very good one. Steele Stanwyck's up there. I like that take.
Nick, Maryland, Virginia, speaking of Stanwyck.
So, fully admit this one. This was a score that I saw at the end and was like, oh man, I'm not even going to watch this one. This is a sad blowout. Final score 12-6. Maryland doubles up Virginia because I was on a flight while this game was happening. And go back and look at how the game unfolded. Oh boy, that last, the final 12-6 does not represent just how close this game was with, at the start of the fourth quarter, Terry, correct me if I'm wrong, it was either a one-goal game or tied, correct?
It was a one-goal game. Truett-Sunderland scored to cut the score to 7-6 with 13:45 to go in the fourth.
And you saw the reaction from Maryland's or from Virginia's bench on just how impactful it was. This was a win that Virginia needed. And ultimately, there were some mistakes. There was a 6-on-4, Virginia getting into some penalty trouble, Spanos taking advantage of it. And ultimately, Maryland pulled away in the end. To me, the biggest takeaway was McNaney is the Entenmann of this season. He is a goalie that Maryland can ride all the way to hoisting the trophy come May. And I don't think there's really a debate about it. I watch the highlights and I watched a chunk of this game looking to be critical of McNaney. How do we beat him? How do we take advantage of him? Where are the holes in Maryland's defense that allows them being any offense really to get good shots off? And quite frankly, there are no good shots off on McNaney. He's a guy who, even if you have a one on none on the doorstep, he was making hero saves all game. So for me, yes, Maryland did get tested and pulled away in the fourth quarter, but it was more of a product of McNaney and Maryland's defense holding Virginia to six. And Virginia has had offensive woes. They were getting reasonably good shots off for at least a decent chunk of the game, and they just couldn't find a way to get the ball past the goalie. And Terry, we'll start with you because Larkin got the first nod for the Ivies.
Yeah, so I mean, this was a backs against the ropes, got to come out swinging, and Virginia did. And ultimately, not only was it not enough, it wasn't nearly enough. And if if the game script had gone differently, could Virginia have put themselves in a position where they were trailing by one with a minute or two left as opposed to 10 minutes to go, and in so doing, figure out a way to sneak it out? Yeah, for sure. They're Virginia. They're really talented. But at the same time, that's not what happened, and that's not what matters. This team is 3-4 now, and with Albany and Utah coming up, who I believe have a combined record of 3-11, my take is, and I this is an opinion, I'm not stating this as fact. I think their season's already over. I don't think that they can make the NCAA tournament, even if they beat Carolina, Notre Dame, and Duke. Based on what their RPI right now, it's 17. I would imagine by this time next week, it's going to be in the mid to low 20s. And even though they still have a decent amount of opportunity available to them with their four remaining ACC games and then potentially ACC tournament games, which obviously would follow if they were to win those, I don't know if they're going to be able to make up enough ground. They've got to get to 11th, probably, based on history, in order to feel confident on Selection Sunday. And if they're at 29th on March 23rd, I just don't see it happening.
And what scares me is, heading into ACC, they could play, not
Spoiler.
securing their own destiny, but ruining other teams' destinies. Let's not forget, I was in an argument the other day where they were like, Nick, oh yeah, you're hitting 7 out of 10 on the panic button because you posted that clip that people had me
You're
lighting
welcome.
up my DMs. Thank you
You're
for
welcome.
that.
You're welcome.
But to your point, people forget that, hey, Notre Dame has won back to back. What happened the year prior? They got snubbed to Mars. So
I
it's
thought
fun
the
to
New Year's
answer.
resolution was to stop complaining about that.
No, New Year's
Okay.
resolution was to get in shape. Oh, also, which I'm not doing.
Pretty sure Brown hosted a tournament game that year. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, you guys got smoked. But what's nice about this time of year is we can start to look at these paths. And Terry, I agree with you. I'm watching this Virginia team, and I go, there's no way they win out. And even if they did, we'll see how things shake out. But full on panic button. Larkin, what do you take away from this game?
Yeah, I'm completely aligned with Terry, and he beat me to that take. I do
Damn
think
it.
this sets up a very interesting, if UVA beats Duke to end the regular season drought, knocks them both out. But ultimately, I think we've been waiting for a reversion to the mean on some of the efficiency statistics to kind of get an understanding of, okay, is Virginia just as bad as the film? Or can they get more out of the athletes, right? And I think what's really concerning for Lars as he does a post-mortem is ultimately they only turned the ball over 9 times to Maryland's 20, right? They went perfect on clears. They turned Maryland over 5 times in the clear. That's a huge turnover spread. The face-off dot didn't go great, but ultimately they out-ground-balled them 32 to 22. And outshot them and still got their head kicked in at home. So it's, you kind of, you sit back, and if you just strip away the Wahoo logo And you strip away the recruiting rankings and some of the branding around these individual players, like, ultimately the team's pretty mediocre. And just as one use case and a question to all athletes considering the transfer portal, like, has Balsamo had a better experience at Virginia than he did at Duke and or usage? I do believe that Virginia can knock off one of the three teams referenced. I'm sure Lars will look to get some people we've never heard of involved to see if he has anything in them as he thinks about how to use his chips and his NIL money for next season in the transfer portal. But, you know, it's dark days. It's dark days in Charlottesville, and it'll be interesting to monitor this summer what happens with respect to, like, transfers in and out.
And Larkin, you bring up an interesting point. I know we're kind of going through more games, but I think this is a relevant question. I think a product of the NIL is going to be teams who can get hot for 1 year can ride that wave way, you know, you're not recruiting, you know, kids that committed 2 years ago. You can recruit as soon as names hit the portal. So in the same way that you can take a year, like Richmond, for example, and tell kids on UVA's roster, hey, you can come and compete at the highest level and ride that wave up. I also think that there's going to be a product of, oh, if you're on a UVA roster, you're probably going to be a high sought after NIL more so than others just because of the branding, because of the recruiting rankings. How much do you think if things play out, UVA misses the playoffs, how bad do you think that's going to tank them for the next year or two, or do they reload with freshmen? This is a good question for Terry. NIL impacting the duration of a bad season, whether it's scooping up guys or whether it's guys fleeing.
So I think, let's just forget lacrosse for a second. Let's use the case study of football, right?
This is a lacrosse. Lacrosse, we can't compare lacrosse and football, Lark, and it's impossible.
Well, just let's put it this way. If you're Dom Starja and Van Arsdale on the back end of when their tenure went south, right, you're waiting on the Ryan Lukovic or the whoever to, quote-unquote, like, change the offensive ingredients. Coaches now, as, like, general managers, have increased flexibility, right? They have increased, like, transfer optionality and increased money to go try and convince someone to come in overnight. If you do not believe, if Lars doesn't believe that his seniors in high school that are already admitted can, like, have that net impact. So I think he has more flexibility. Now, whether he can pull it off is a totally different question because the optionality for the kids has also gone up. So it's, you not only need to recruit, you know, he's going to be watching film of, like, all of the laggards across all conferences and basically calling these kids saying, hey, you know, you're currently at Brown. They went X, right? Why don't you come to UVA? We can overpay you, blah, blah, blah. So it's, I think that there's, you know, poaching, all the different things that go into kind of watching film and thinking about who we can go get, D1, D3, all levels. But, you know, the reality is that the stock of the University of Virginia is a lot lower than it was 24 months ago when they were on top of the world. So it's, you know, would I bet against him? Of course not. Like, I think he's a great lacrosse coach. And the one thing he has to think about, I know we're off subject here, is his system worked with Dylan Malloy and Connor Schellenberg. Those are two of the best lacrosse players to, like, ever play. Like, they're really good. So the question more becomes, he's been coaching for 30 years, right? There were years where he was 6-8 for, like, a lifetime with great goaltending and whatever. So what he just needs, what he's thinking through, I'm sure, is, hey, how do I get to a level of consistency of John Tillman? How do I think through kind of the hybrid solution of both who are the right coordinators and what is the right level of turnover appetite and pace to match UVA's recruiting and athleticism with, like, sustained success, and not rely on generational ball carriers to just make it so hard to defend that go, go, go is, like, the perfect solution.
So I want to answer your question, Nick, but I have to provide the normal caveat, which is that I think the notion of NIL is wildly overrated when it comes to every sport other than football and basketball.
More transfer portal than NIL, I guess.
100%. Absolutely. That being said, I don't want to completely dismiss it because I do think that, you know, $100,000 to $150,000 in NIL is actually enough to move the needle. And the thing is that while we sit here in this podcast and a lot of people listening to it think that most college lacrosse programs can find 150 grand in the couch cushions. That's not really true, and it's particularly not really true every single year. And so I think the question is, what motivates alumni to get engaged? And if you're at certain programs, very little motivates them more than losing. And so in this particular scenario, I could see a situation where the deep-pocketed Virginia alums say, we can't let this happen again, and we are going to attack it with our pocketbooks. That being said, I actually don't really think that talent is kind of going to be the issue. I think this year they don't have enough talent. I think that the gap between their fourth and fifth best offensive player is too wide, and that is where their unsustainability or infrequency or inconsistency comes in settled offense. Next, I think that there's a couple of very obvious reasons for that. One of them is that Ryan Dunkel, Kyle Colsey, and Sean Brown are on the sideline, not playing this year. Now, that's not an immediate panacea for a couple of reasons. Number one, Ryan Dunkel has the type of injury that you wonder whether he's ever going to be able to play again. Or injury history, not like particular injury. Kyle Colsey might need a year to get back, you know, coming off of an ACL. Sean Brown, I think, is going to hit the ground running. He had a wrist injury. I don't anticipate that. I mean, he might be some of the way, if not most of the way back already. It's just not worth burning a year of eligibility in order to come back. And then you add Brendan Millen to the situation. Hudson Osman, Joey Terenzi grow up a year. Certainly losing Ben Ware is going to hurt, but Robbie Hopper is as close to an approximation for Ben Ware as can be. And we've seen long sticks come in and compete. And you know, there's certain positions on the field that it takes a little bit more to acclimate. And Larkin, you can speak to this obviously better than I can, but I don't think long stick midi is one of those with like a super steep learning curve. And so, you know, you can expect Hopper to come in and cause the havoc that he did. I was at McDonough Chaminade on Friday night, and I'm going to see Hopper on Wednesday. And I mean, Brendan Millen was not the best player on the field. I think James Gillis was, but he was still exceptional and so clutch. He scored a goal with about 30 seconds left, falling down, no angle, no room to shoot at on Kieran Walsh, the next Liam Entenmann, and it went in to cut the game to one. And then they lose the faceoff. They immediately get the ball back off of a timeout. And there's just a heave down the field. And even though he got harassed and knocked to the ground and de-sticked, the catch that Millen made off a bouncer, a 70-yard bounce pass, was one of the most athletic things that I've seen so far this season. So the point is that there is going to be more talent on this roster next year than there is this year. It kind of reminds me of Carolina last year versus this year, and 2 years ago versus last year, specifically with Owen Duffy and Don Petromala kind of joining the fray. So there's already no doubt that Virginia is going to be better next year than they are this year. What then the question becomes is that normal growth curve of experience, and you wonder, can you import that through the portal and accelerate the process? And then you find yourself in a situation that Syracuse was in last year, where they have their sophomores who grew up. You import Jordan Stevens and Sammy English, who have made it to a Final Four, and they can help a little bit, but ultimately they're not going to be the reason you get over the hump. It's your homegrown talent that is going to be the difference between whether or not you win or lose on quarterfinal weekend. And so if that's the standard that Virginia is trying to get to, if I'm in fact right and they don't make the NCAA tournament this year, then certainly getting to the quarters is going to be a win next year. But if you want something beyond that, then I think you're going to need to be patient, not look to 26. You're going to have to look for 27. There was a lot there. I'm sorry. We're a half hour in. We're only two games in. Nick, take us to Duke Richmond.
Unbelievable game. The Duke Blue Devils come away with a win after a double OT thriller. Now, this was a game in which Duke kept capturing lead, and Richmond just pulled the lead corso three times throughout the game, saying, "Not so fast, my friend. We are here to play, and we are going to stay." An incredible performance from, I mean, geez, where do you even start? Chinoy, the Richmond faceoff man, providing two massive juice goals. Lil John is one of the all-time inside finishers. When there is crunch time...
Did you just change his name to L-I apostrophe L-J-O-H-N?
I was doing it last night, and I'm like, I know it's Lil John, but I'm like, Lil John, he has so much swagger on the inside of the crease that, like, you kind of have to warrant that change.
Yeah!
I'll leave this podcast now if you do that one more time. But
that's what he says, right? That's Lil John. I got that right, correct?
Yeah, it just blew out my ear. So, what I loved about Richmond's comebacks is it seemed like some of the goals were like, oh, this is a panic button. There's no way that this works. A shot goes or a force feed inside, balls on the ground. Little John just somehow comes away with it and buries it. God damn it, Terry. This is where it's going to kill me to not have my notes. Terry, number 15 for Duke, lefty, high to high on the run.
Abe McGuire?
No, the lefty.
15. Oh, Max Lowe.
Max Sloat pretty much kept Duke in this game in a lot of ways. He has a lefty on the run that is just unstoppable. So Duke gets the lead three times throughout the game. Richmond comes back. Ultimately, it was Aiden McGuire who put together an unbelievable game. I mean, I know I mentioned that he's one of my favorite non-Notre Dame players. He is my favorite non-Notre Dame player now. Throwing can openers, playing great short safety middies. At the second overtime, Duke wins the faceoff. I can't remember the pull, but he kind of flips it to Aiden McGuire, who runs down and throws a sidearm low to high on the run, completely gets Richmond goalie going down low. And brings it home for the Duke Blue Devils. Richmond is a real player in this game, in this season, and Duke narrowly escapes what would be a marquee win for Richmond.
I had two things to clean up for you. Cole Kross, 66, the long stick that came up with that GB. And my question for both of you guys, were Aiden McGuire's eyes open when he took that shot? Because when it came out of his stick, I was like, he wants that to go over the crossbar and get a reset.
I mean, anytime an SSDM's coming down, what I always tell them is aim for the logo because they're going to pull it or yank it. It's just a question of how hard. So, yeah, it's eyes closed. No question about it.
Eyes open. Don't ever talk about my boy Aiden McGuire like that. People forget some of these short stick D middies were their marquee scores. You don't have that coming down and then bringing it back up. And it's the perfect shot because you're either A, missing or B, scoring. Like there was no chance that that was going to be a clean save going back down the other way. Eyes open. Love him.
Larkin, what you got?
My point is just for those who didn't watch the film, this is a game in which Duke got 13 saves and Richmond got eight. I think a lot of people would have assumed that stat to be flipped. Like the 6v6 kind of just stripped clips are very even. And my main takeaway here is that my sleeper stock has been Duke for no other reason than the years in which Danowski's down and out and like the roster seems depleted is when he kind of goes on the fairly bizarre, 8 to 12 seed Final Four run. And I think I'm ready to put that to bed. I think Duke's just okay. And will they ultimately get to the NCAA tournament? Potentially. But it's hard for me to envision a path of like severe outperformance over the next month based on the tape. And for Richmond, it's like they have three massive moral victories where the whole world's like, okay, Richmond, you're now playing in the big sandbox. But ultimately, from the RPI perspective, like it doesn't matter at all. And their only path is through the conference automatic qualifier. And my second quick take is St. Joe's has woken up. And Taylor Rhea is a pretty scary guy. So for those just like sharpieing in Richmond into the first round, I would say slow down.
All right, I'm going to do this thing that I actually really enjoy doing, Larkin, which is reacting directly to your points. So the first is I'm going to tell you to hold that Duke stock. I understand exactly where you're coming from, but I actually think that you're kind of misanalyzing what the point is, and it's that they are not good enough such that they won't be committed to getting better. And I think that ultimately those are the deltas between the good John Donowski teams, or which are the teams that are committed to getting better in late March and early April versus which are the ones that think that they're good enough. And I think this team, it knows it's not good enough in order to not get better. And so I think that's, to me, why I would buy Duke right now. Because I do look around at the playmakers and I'm like, there's a lot more talent here than a Duke is not as talented as Duke has been because of what they graduated last year take would imply. So that's the first thing. The second thing is my like penciled intake coming into this part of the podcast was this is the year that Richmond makes the quarterfinals. Like I think that the moral victory point is well taken. But I think that the other thing that you said that I wholeheartedly agree with is you would normally expect Zach Vigeau to outplay Patrick Jameson. And I think that in a first-round NCAA tournament game where they're going to be matched up against a team in the Duke tier, not like, you know, Duke in the NCAA tournament based on what you just said, but also based on like where our perception or conception of them will be, you know, that is what I think we're going to see. And then the last thing is, yeah, one of us either said or wrote at some point in the last couple weeks, I don't remember what adjective or adverb it was, but that Richmond was like safely, securely, or something like that, the favorite in the Big Ten. And I think your point is well taken. But I actually think, and we're going to get to this, it's not just St. Joe's, it's also the Minutemen. Yeah. I think that the A-10 is a little bit crunchier, more crunched up is probably a better way of saying that at the top, than Richmond's performances against Virginia, Cornell, and Duke would suggest.
And then, point for me, Larkin, I would disagree that the sixes were even. It seemed to me like Duke, especially when McAdory and Sloat got heads of steam, they were decimating their individual matchups. Especially totally. There was one particular, like, McAdory had a full head of steam and ran by, like, four Richmond defenders up top. It was kind of a semi-unsettled situation, and I expected that to be a goal, and it ended up not being a goal. I think
he could do that to Team USA, so that's why it's insane that Duke, like, didn't win last year and hasn't, you know what I mean? I mean, he's so fast.
but to Terry's point, I think they have things that they can rely on that they can start implementing in the first and second quarter, as opposed to Richmond. I feel they were kind of running some like funky wing dodges and were like, you know, kind of having to play a little bit of an interesting game ultimately before saying, hey, we need to mount a comeback. Let's just, you know, close our eyes and fire it to Little John on the crease.
Speaking of Lil Jon, if he had scored the game winner with like 2 seconds left in the first overtime, that would have been one of the most epic game winners ever. If you haven't seen that clip, I'll make sure that it gets posted inside the Cross's Instagram, because Evan O'Neill with the end line restart with like 4 seconds left, and he just jams the crease, and it was like a Superman dive. Yeah, it would have been incredible. Nick, Harvard Yale.
Boy, Sam King, good at lacrosse, is a big takeaway. So Harvard wins this game 14-11, and honestly, there's a lot that we can take away from this game, offensive, defensively, but at the end of the day, Harvard just out-physicaled Yale. And I think this was the game, you know, you talk about rivalry games, you talk about how Yale's season has gone, you talk about having your back against the wall if you're UVA. Yale does not have a lot, you know, much to play for this season. So I was kind of expecting this to be a slugfest, and certainly wouldn't have been surprised if Yale came away with a victory. But instead, number 13 ranked in the country, Harvard, kind of puts a little exclamation point, not just on, I think it's what, the 103rd? Iteration of this game, 106. See, that's where the notes are going to get me today. But a statement victory from a physicality perspective. Granted, I do want to say Sam King took 17 shots. So, hey, how about you provide a little more accuracy? But well-balanced Harvard offense. And again, it was the physicality. It was the rides. It was the clears. It was the face-off. That was the overarching theme to everything that was happening and why Harvard was able to get a 3-goal victory. Larkin, we'll start with you, Ivy League.
Some kid at a finals club's really upset you didn't know it was the 106th version of the game this year. But
nerd.
So, you know, ultimately, I've been a Harvard hater. I think that Terry nailed the Princeton point with respect to FOGO efficiency. The big question mark for Jerry Burns' squad remains at the X, at the stripe. I was very surprised by the first quarter. Again, I just felt like Yale has more in the tank. I felt like there's kids on that team who have won big games, been in large moments. Andy Shea's a great motivator. He's also someone on a personal level who's had Harvard's number. But, I mean, this was an ass-kicking. I mean, this was a individual battles won by Harvard all over the field, you know, off the turf, uppers, downers. I mean, it really was. I actually thought it was worse than the scoreline, if that makes any sense. So, huge win for Jerry personally. Like, I think that this kind of fortifies his position as, like, someone who's trending and building there. And I think the alums will respond very well to that. And I also think that this was a game, I think, to Terry's point about Duke and their investment in willingness to develop this spring, I think this was a game that would have jump-started Shea's ability to hold his senior class accountable about Yale trying to knock off, you know, Brown, Dartmouth, Harvard, and backdoor their way into the Ivy tournament at 3-3. And I think their path is almost impossible now. So credit to
you. Don't think
guys.
That it's just as possible to go Brown, Dartmouth, Penn?
I think Yale may be favored in terms of talent level in that game, but I think just based on the nature of the way they've started, I think Murph will be able to keep the group together a little bit longer. So I'm not sure I want to like bet my line.
Yeah, I'm not asking for that.
Yale, but it's just tough at 1-4. I think to kind of stay where you need to be. I mean, I'm not trying to. I don't know the seniors personally there, and maybe those captains are great dudes and alphas. So, you know, listen, I hope they prove me wrong. I like when the Ivy's playing better ball and the strength of schedule's up, but it's dark times, man. And I think there's coaching changes coming at the coordinator level, and I'm happy to speak to that in long form pros this week.
Terry, before we get to your point, I'd just like to give a shout out to Max Adler, avid listener of the podcast, and he even sent me a text that said I'm too high on Jerry and Harvard. This was a statement win. Hey, Max, why don't you go ahead and suck it? I look forward to the text that you get. Let me being right ruin your day. And why don't you come to Boise, Idaho and say something that you got to say to my face? Because I know you won't, because you're not athletic. You're just a fogo. And by the way, you're a fogo who I would beat in practice every time. And it wouldn't be worth my time to take another draw against you. So, Terry, with that, Harvard Yale.
That was really mean. Like,
oh, yeah.
Wow.
To a really nice kid, by the way.
You want me to send a screenshot of the text he sends me, Larkin? I will right after this.
I just never thought I'd see the day. I think that both ends of the spectrum are as far in terms of, you know, how tough and physical Yale is viewed as being over the course of the last 15 years relative to how tough and physical Harvard is not viewed as having been over the last 15 years. And so... I mean, it was so clear in the stats, right? Yale cleared at 66%. Harvard caused 14 turnovers. And there were so many strips and just knocking the ball out of guys' sticks and then knocking the ball carrier to the ground such that he wasn't in a position to try to recover the ground ball. I mean, you know, to Larkin's point about it being an ass-kicking, I don't think there's an other explanation or another description of it. And what's crazy is that Yale's already had this once this year. This was not that different from the Army game. It just, I think, more than anything else, kind of illustrates that Army is very for real and Harvard is kind of like a mid-teens team. Or, you know, whatever, 12th, I don't know. I think that... I don't think all is lost for Yale. I talked to Andy Shea after their Denver win, and with respect to the Army game, he pointed out that, you know, they still have a lot of injuries and a lot of soft tissue injuries and the types of injuries that they were trying to avoid by being overly physical in practice. This is a program where, you know, anybody who's gone to a Yale practice from 2011 to 2019 or whatever came away saying, like, how do these guys make it through the season? Like, they just beat the crap out of each other every single day. And he was talking about how he was blowing whistles early in the week leading up to Army because he was afraid of guys getting hurt and that they were running up against, you know, the depth of contribution. And so after that Army game and how embarrassing it was, he just reverted back to the normal approach of prison rules and, you know, late whistles, if any whistles at all. And maybe it started, he said that he felt like, it, you know, it started to manifest a little bit against Penn State, even though that was a loss, and then, you know, manifested more against Denver, even though they would have liked to have closed that game out a little bit more securely. And I think that while the final score was not as indicative of, you know, the final score flattered Yale is probably a way of saying it, as a four-goal Harvard win. Larkin, I also think you hit the nail on the head, which is that after the first 10 minutes, it was a comparatively even game, not just on the scoreboard, but much more so in terms of, I still think Harvard outplayed them physically, but I think that Yale was actually skilled enough and they had enough of a possession advantage in order to be able to potentially win it despite being out physical. And so that is the reason that I'm not giving up on the notion of their ability to go 3-3 in the Ivy League, get the 4 seed. And then this program was built on getting hot to days in early May. So who knows? But there's definitely you know, a departure between the DNA of what this team's been since 2011 and what this team is this year. And I think that it's probably going to create some interesting conversations between the guys on this group and on this team with their alums. Nick, Hopkins Navy.
Ooh, interesting one. Very interesting one. So biggest storyline coming out of this, Terry, can you just help me pronounce his name? Because he played good enough where I don't want to butcher it.
Let's go with Oren Gelinas.
It was either Gelinas or Gelinas, and I'm like, both of those sound wrong. I was debating about it before.
I'm always predisposed to say, like, Gelinas, but I think it's Gelinas.
Yeah.
Gelinas, tomato, tomato.
Yeah, someone will come out and correct this. Oren Gelinas. So, transferred from Ohio State, has not played a game as a Johns Hopkins player, let alone their marquee goaltender. He comes in and does, for all intents and purposes, a fantastic job. 14 saves, 61% save percentage, and it was a much-needed quality goaltender performance because Hopkins, who also was welcoming back Russell Melendez, so kind of a welcome back from the injury party. Hey, Hopkins can now kind of implement their roster. Their offense was struggling, and it was more a product of just not putting shots on cage than it was anything else. They were shooting at a clip of 20% on cage throughout the game, which I don't care how, you know, quality the shots are. If you're shooting 20% on cage, it's going to be a struggle. Ultimate score was 12-9. Navy made it certainly a more interesting game than some people might have thought, but how do we weigh welcome back to the roster versus slow start for Hopkins offense versus giving, you know, Navy their just due?
So for me, Navy deserves a lot of credit, not just because of the fact that they're doing this without their tattoo faceoff guys and Logan Callahan won 20-24, but also they just always play Hopkins tough. And that's why if I'm a Hopkins fan, and you start to take a critical look at the way that your season has unfolded so far in terms of the quality of the teams that you beat relative to how good you thought they were when you beat them, yeah, it's cause for concern. But I wouldn't overreact to this game. I mean, this is a game that Navy has gotten the last couple of years when these two teams' seasons have ended in remarkably different fashions. And so as a result, you know, if I'm a Hopkins fan, I'm like, we're playing without our starting goalie, who, yes, was outplayed by the guy making his first career start, and we obviously had an enormous possession advantage, and still, this was a game that was in doubt in the fourth quarter, but I also think it's one of the, you know, kind of oldest, most historic rivalries in the sport being played against a very prideful group in Annapolis, and this strikes me as a take-your-money-and-run scenario. I'm not going to overreact. If it was closer than I felt like it should have been based on the talent delta between these two teams, if I'm a Hopkins fan.
I think that's really well said. I think Navy has evolved into the Oregon State, Oregon metaphor with respect to throw away the tape on incoming RPI. It's just always a good contest. Like I get like borderline emotional when I pop up the ESPN Plus and I see the names of all the famous battles. Like I love watching ball at Navy Stadium. And the one long-term question I have is just with respect to Navy's resources and, you know, how passionate that alumni base is and candidly their assistant coaching salary pool and like the impact that has in terms of like expectation, you know, when Navy's going to show some life, especially offensively. But, you know, I think this was a on-brand, on-serve Hopkins is what we think they are. You know, let's not overthink this one. So I think Terry nailed it. I think Hopkins, what they need to think about is, hey, if we don't just want to like make the tournament, right? What is our path to the Final Four? And is there someone on the bench who can act as a spark plug or a short term catalyst just for a different look or different structure? Because ultimately, like we have a decent amount of film on how they currently play, and I think it's B+. And
I think that they kind of found that in Charlie Eiler. I mean, he was a guy who, when I was told in January he was in the mix to start at X, I was shocked because he was injured all of last year, and I didn't even think that that was kind of his natural position. And, you know, against Syracuse, Kark was very complimentary of the combination of his, you know, slipperiness and creativity as well as his chutzpah. I don't know. It's St. Patrick's Day, so let's turn to a Yiddish term. But I think that if you're looking to raise the ceiling to an A-, it is, how do we get Russell Melendez, if not back to full health, at least like near, as near full health as possible, and then combine forces with Eiler?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And it's also the low right wing, because ultimately, like, to free up Chavet, right, you want those south-north feeding lanes, and you want to focus on that right side pair and not rely so heavily on the lefties.
Larkin, that was a nice little Oregon State's nickname is the Civil War, and then you were talking about how Navy plays well. I don't. There might be a couple little layers, even though the Navy didn't have a huge impact on the Civil War.
I go to a school where we get desensitized to things like that, Nick, so we don't say the Civil War anymore.
Oh, okay.
I didn't name the game, but I'm sure it'll be called, like, you know, something else soon. Or maybe not, you know, with the administration.
The silly scuffle, you know? Who knows?
Civil conflict remains my favorite trophy that's ever been created in the history of rivalry games. Nick, Notre Dame, Michigan. Speaking of rivalry games, sort of.
Speaking of rivalry games that aren't really rivalry games, it's the circle of suck right now. Ohio State owns Notre Dame. Notre Dame owns Michigan. Michigan owns Ohio State. So, bottom line, Notre Dame drops to Maryland and Ohio State and just comes out and beats the piss out of Michigan. A lot of guys getting in on the action, a couple first-time scorers. I don't know. I didn't take a lot away from this game other than, oh, nice. That's good to see. That's what should have happened. So I'm not going to go too far in and not get overreactionary other than, hey, this was a good way to write the course. We understand Michigan, no offense to them, is not of the quality of the teams that we've lost so far. But with that being said, you know, hey, good way to build momentum is to go take it out on Lil Bro.
Yeah, my only takeaway, and I'll pose it as a question, right? Ultimately, like, if you're in this sport, you want coaching salaries to increase. You want engagement to go up. And that also means we need to be willing to turn up the seat, you know, the heat and the willingness to engage in what is, like, conflict-based questioning. Michigan is a top-five job in the sport. Like, anyone who has gone to a football game or a hockey game at Yost Arena knows the resources and the passion and the ability to recruit. Like, I appreciate the fact that Michigan showed some life winning the Big Ten tournament. I think 2 years in a row. Is that correct, yep. Terry?
That's right.
But ultimately, they've regressed. The film is very average right now. And the same way I hold Jerry Byrne accountable, because I think Harvard's a way better job than Penn or Brown, you know, I think it's fair to ask questions about Kevin, and more specifically to ask questions about the defensive efficiency over time, because that's his bread and butter. And you know, if he wants to mother F me, that's fine. But I would also tell him that if he ever wants to double his salary, the sport needs to get to a place where that's okay to say out loud. So, you know, it's just it's a situation in which they too consistently get on the plane to kind of a program that has more tradition, but in reality is equal on recruiting ground, and get their head kicked in. And, like, you know, if that was Brown, we would do something about it. So it's just, you know, who knows, but rough film.
Spicy take for what is a early Sunday afternoon here on the East Coast. But so here's my, I don't even know. I don't know what this is. Let's just call it context. So initial contract was a 5-year deal, signed an extension after 2022. At this point in 2023, they were 3-4. They actually they beat Maryland, but then they lost three of their subsequent four games. But then kind of salvaged their season with a year end regular season ending win over Ohio State. Then beat them in the quarterfinals. Came to Hopkins, where the Big Ten tournament was. Won back to back games. Made it to the NCAA tournament for the first time in program history, beat Denver, and then fell to Duke in the quarterfinals in a really rough game, weather-wise, at Albany. And then the following year basically unfolded identically, and on the broadcast of this Notre Dame game, Mark Dixon pointed out the only difference in the record between this year and last year is, I believe, the loss to Harvard. And I think that's effectively right. So, you know, I don't know how long Kevin's extension was. It could be FOIA'd. I'm not really in the market for that. But at the same time, I don't really think that it would be fair to evaluate the... I mean, certainly I don't think it's fair to evaluate it now, because effectively what I just said is they've been in this position the last 2 years and completely redeemed their season. So I think at this point you kind of have to default to the fact that that's the likely outcome here. If it doesn't happen, then you start to look at it from the standpoint of like, all right, we're not going to overreact in 1 year. Let's give it 2 years and then see what happens after that. Now, I understand that you're talking about more program-wide. If I'm going to get granular on the questions that I have about the intermediate term future of this program, it's the same question that I had coming into this year, which is that I gave a lot of credit to the group of seniors that graduated last year for the role that they played in turning those seasons around in 23 and 24. And I remember distinctly sitting in the press conference after either the Big Ten semis or championship game and asking about one of the players was wearing a t-shirt that just said Hardo on it. And my question was like, what's that all about? And going back to the club days, John Paul used to always talk about the difficulty of how they transitioned was they went from being club 1 year to varsity the next, which effectively meant that they had somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 to 3 classes of club lacrosse players on a varsity roster. And that was the DNA and lineage. I mean, we talked about it with respect to Yale. I mean, it took Indy either 6 or 7 years to make the NCAA tournament for the first time, and that was at Yale, right? Like, John Reese played there. It's an Ivy League school, right? It's a completely different situation from the standpoint of the temptation and everything else that can distract you when you're at Michigan. And so the point is that that group is what changed the culture at Michigan from you were a hardo if you cared and worked hard to caring and working hard is what made you cool. And the rewards followed. The results followed. And the question that I have is just, does that standard maintain upon the graduation of the group that instituted it or that instilled it? And I don't think it's possible to know from the outside. And I think ultimately that's why we as outsiders are going to evaluate on the basis of how the season unfolds and what the results are. And the only caveat that I would put to that is that, you know, sometimes there are valid mitigating factors. So it's not to make an argument one way or the other about a coach, but I think Larkin, if you were going to retort, the primary retort would be, while there is no substitute for a player-led culture and the accountability that follows, it is the coach's responsibility to create the environment such that a player-led culture is able to follow, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the easiest critique is like, hey, you know, Ward Manuel doesn't give a hoot about lacrosse. And my response to the alums would be, well, then make him care. Find a way to be important enough to the football fundraising in the basketball growth project, you know, trajectory, that like he cares about lacrosse. Joe Tsai's the biggest donor at Yale. Not lacrosse donor, like donor. You think the Yale AD is like calling him, updating him on the lacrosse practice film? You bet it, man. So ultimately, like, if Ohio State and Michigan want to get good at lacrosse, it's going to start with the alums forcing the ADs to care and to hold those staffs accountable. Because, you know, gun to head, who would I rather have, Dan Chamati or Kevin Connery right now? That'd be my question, but let's move on.
Nick, Army, Lehigh, quick one.
And quickly on your point, we made 2 trips up to Ann Arbor to watch Notre Dame play at Ann Arbor when I was a member of the Irish. 2 of the greatest nights of my life. Like, you want to recruit, send him up, send him to a football game and just watch their eyes explode. It's incredible. So hoping that Michigan kind of takes over Maryland's spot in the next 10 years from a recruiting standpoint, but we'll put all that aside. Army is allergic to not killing teams. Like, it's kind of unbelievable. Their closest games, I'm looking at their schedule right now, a 6-goal win over Rutgers. And that's really as close as it gets. They just, you know, absolutely destroyed team. And we haven't talked about them because I do want to give the caveat. Their biggest wins, you know, Yale, Rutgers, and, you know, a 7-goal win over UMass to kick the season off. We'll talk about UMass here in a second. But we haven't given Army the light of day because of their schedule. But now we can't ignore them. Most recent win, 13-4 over Lehigh. We'll start with you, Terry. I know you're a big fan of West Point and the boys. What do you got?
Yeah, so to do this without Will Coletti and have Sean Dow run roughshod makes the win even more impressive. Jackson Eicher, best game of his career statistically, 6 goals. He's up to 22 goals and 22 assists in 7 games. He is a bona fide Torden contender, and if the invitations for the trip to DC went out tomorrow, I think he gets one of the five.
I think the Middy's better. Is that
Well, first of all, are you talking about Hill or Evan? Because Hill Plunkett is coming on hard. I assume you're talking about Evan, and he's the better player, and probably better than Jackson Eicher, but holy shit. Right.
To your point, I think it's an attack-oriented award, similar to like quarterbacks or running backs in football, so that's fair. But my take on Army, which is a little more bearish and unfortunate because I'm a huge fan of that program and that staff, is it's my opinion that the Patriot League, being as down as they are, which is totally out of Army's control, will make it so that Army's not battle-tested enough by May, right? We have this massive matchup with Carolina. I'm not sure how it's going to go. I hope Army wins. We're then going to enter a five-week stretch where Army basically plays nobody, right? Because even, you know, as they stumble their way through the Patriot League tournament, typically the BUs and the Loyolas have an elevated air to them, both in terms of like their credibility on film, but also just like the individual talent level, like the Roy Myers, and Loyola typically has a couple guys. And so I just get nervous. Like, Army's going to be a, you know, one-loss team or zero-loss team hosting as a top-four seed in the tournament. In that game, they are going to find themselves up against a, you know, a Princeton or whoever. Like, Richmond. It's going to be a great team. Right, a Richmond. I get a little bit scared and nervous. The best use case I can think of is when, was it UMass that hosted when Will Manning was there?
Yes.
As like the one seed maybe and got beat by Colgate. Like, I just get a little bit scared about, we're all going to be so excited about like America's team, like patriotism. And I get a little bit nervous about the road bump. And I hope the committee slots them appropriately and doesn't give them a kind of tough game. But yeah.
Nick, why do you think Larkin hates the troops?
You know, he's in Stanford. You know, it's a weird time to be at higher education. I don't know what his thoughts are. I'm not going to bring politics into this. But Larkin, you know, looking at America's role as world police, I mean, what do you see going on, and where do you think we should intervene?
I think there's an unfortunate disconnect between Trump hysteria and the reality of like reciprocal tariffs. There is no world in which the toughest dudes on the planet should protect the Canadian border, and Canada should not spend 2% of their GDP, which they committed in 2014 to Crimea, to the Eastern NATO installment. So it's my belief that this Trump stuff and the trade war catalyst is long-term negative, but I think our allies should act as our allies, because we got dudes like the United States Military Academy who are going to go protect them for free.
How do you feel about booing the national anthem when you are playing a hockey game?
I think that Baltimore should stop saying things during the national anthem and should have some respect. Oh!
I don't hate it.
Derry, Army, lacrosse.
I already gave my take.
Yeah. I'm asking, like, any thoughts before we move on?
No, I already gave them. Jackson Eicher, Torton finalist.
God forbid I just ask if you had any last second thoughts before we
you
move
forgot.
On.
Don't play that game. You forgot that I already gave my point.
No, I was like, Terry, well, I should have said anything else on Army.
Okay, there you go.
I'll nothing else on Army. Because this is like my favorite coach in college lacrosse. Does anybody get more out of the group than Greg Kinella? The original Tom Osborne coach of the week. Like, this guy just churns out 7-1 every year somehow. When it's like, I can't name a...
That's the important part. He doesn't do it when they have expectations. He only does it when you think they're going to suck.
Right. Exactly. UMass beats Rutgers 11-7, I believe.
That's right.
Nick, set us up.
UMass beats Rutgers 11-7. Terry, what do you got?
I mean, so I got bullied into ranking UMass last week, and they immediately
vicious
fell behind.
Alumni.
they immediately fell behind to Rutgers. And I was like, yep, that's what I get. That's what I get for not standing on my own, whatever, opinions or whatever. But no, the Minutemen do what they do. And what's crazy, and first of all, like, I haven't watched enough of them. I watched their Army game, which was their lone loss of the season and was at this point almost 2 months ago. So I don't have a ton of analysis on this one. I'm going to put them at the top of the docket, watching film as soon as we finish recording. But with that being said, I think it just bears pointing out that they're doing this without the guy who won the game for Ohio State against Notre Dame last week, a grad transfer in Shane O'Leary, and then Mason Bregman, who also transferred to Ohio State. And those aren't the only guys. Now, I do know that they benefited from a little bit of an influx from Merrimack, and I know, Nick, that you can speak to the quality of those guys. But I'm with Larkin. There's just not much more to be said than how good of a job Greg Cannella has done with this group. And on some, again, like, it's only a surprise if you don't understand the trend, which is that they underperform when there are expectations, and they vastly overperform when there aren't.
And I'm going to make a long-term forecast here just for fun. Super hot take. For those who don't know, UMass was able to raise a bunch of money about 8 years ago and recruit the St. Lawrence hockey coach, who was an NHL quality coach, was doing incredible things up at St. Lawrence. And basically overnight was able to recruit Cale Makar and like five other first round, second round NHL type draft picks because they gave them the resources to be competitive, both on like a budget scholarship level, but also kind of NIL and all those different things. I think UMass is one of the most interesting jobs in the sport because of the nature of like Cannella's built such a foundation of like toughness and quality ball that if the school ever made a decision to like give up on this Division I football dream, right? They've kind of gone back and forth. They get their head kicked in every single year. They like get a new coach. Then they go back to Mark Whipple. Then they do it again. They just keep losing. Like, I think that Massachusetts has such a great culture of high school lacrosse and high school coaches and high IQ play that UMass is this kind of sleeping giant. And if and when Greg retires, well, candidly, I hope they give him the resources now so that he can do it. But if not, I think it becomes a really interesting role. And credit to him. And I like the fact that the A-10 with St. Joe's, Richmond, not in this order, and UMass are going to have a really compelling tournament because I'm assuming that's going to be a one-bid league. But those are three pretty good teams. So it's going to be fun to watch that unfold. And it's always nice when some of the lesser-than tournaments have like real implications and high-quality film.
I just want to shout out, kind of like put it on your radar for 6 or 7 weeks from now because we're on the back of college basketball conference tournament week. There is legitimately no better day of college lacrosse than the Thursday of college tournament week, you know, conference tournament weekend. I haven't committed the schedules to memory, so things could have changed, but for the last 6 or 7 years, it's basically 16 games that start at, usually the MAC has their first game at like 10 or 11 a.m. And then some years when Denver has hosted the Big East tournament, the last game started at like 9 p.m. And every single game has stakes because, to Larkin's point, you're watching lacrosse where like 6 of the 8 leagues at least are one bid leagues. And the action is absolutely reflective of it because there are teams, there are seniors playing their last game of their career, and they are doing everything to make sure that they get an opportunity to play on Saturday. So just make sure you take that day off. It's going to be like April 25th or something like that.
And now we do, right, what, a little bit of a round table?
Yeah, I'll get us going with Bucknell beat Colgate. Colgate has been one of the more divisive teams in terms of, you know, kind of the future indicator or past indicator, I suppose. Certainly their win over Harvard became very difficult to square when 4 days later Harvard beat Syracuse. And when you combined that with the fact that Colgate had lost to Penn State and Virginia out of the gate, Virginia then subsequently lost to Richmond and then proceeded to now fall to 3-4. That made that loss look a little bit worse. But they had won 5 straight games. And, we've talked about it at this point for 2 years. They are so hard to play against because of their 10-man ride. But when you're comfortable with it and when you're good at playing against it, which some of their conference rivals are going to be better at playing against it than some of their non-conference opponents are going to be. And there is also, you know, and maybe I'm a little bit dating myself, but I think back to the Brandon Corp days and there was a quasi Colgate-Bucknell rivalry there. This was the type of result that if you're a Bison fan, I don't want to say it makes your season, but it definitely pours some sugar on what's otherwise been a pretty disappointing couple years for what is otherwise, you know, a relatively typical Bucknell team in terms of the top end talent, but then not necessarily kind of seeing that production round out as the group moves down. Connor Davis is like fifth in terms of career goals for active players in NCAA right now, maybe even higher than that. So yeah, Bucknell beat Colgate. Ray Bucknell.
All right, my take is that we haven't talked about Utah. They're 1-6. We had them on. We had Cody Hart on after they beat Ohio State by 6. Outside of their 10-goal loss to Syracuse, they have a -1 score differential in the 5 other losses. Lost by 1 to Delaware, 2 to Denver, 1 to Vermont, 2 to Dartmouth, and an OT loss to Marquette. I think Utah sneaks one past Virginia. Virginia completely buries their season. Utah's due. They are the anti-Army. They aren't winning games, and they are allergic to blowout losses. They had one bad rep against Syracuse, but my goodness, this is the team that's due for a win. Their season's kind of already on the back burner right now, with their record being 1-6, and this is what they're circling on their calendar is. This is our chance to make this season, to your point, Terry. Let's put a little sugar on what's otherwise been this shit Sunday, and let's go out. Virginia, they're kind of asleep at the wheel. They're saying, hey, we've lost a couple. We really got to focus for ACC play. I think it's a trap game, and I think Utah's due. And I just like the Utes. I'm sorry. Cody was such a good dude that I want to see him and the boys, you know, rally around taking down the Hoos.
Two very quick ones. I want to give a stick tap to Sean Kerwin, dear friend of the family, and say that the number one thing you need to do when you take over a toilet bowl program is you need to elevate them above the muffins, and you need to remind the room that, like, we're playing for something bigger than beating up on, like, Vermont once a year. Listen, they got a really easy schedule. They're also 6-1, right? And Brendan Callahan and Andy Towers couldn't do that consistently. So, like, the first job is to do that, to do that first kind of bullet point, so you can remind recruits that, hey, you know, we don't go 3-12 every year. Now it's going to get a lot harder, obviously, as they go play the Penns, Cornells, Princetons, etc. I have no idea if they're competitive enough to clip, you know, really. Brown's going to be a good game this year, but, you know, will they win more than one game in the Ivy? I'm not sure, but he's done the harder part. So I hope that people look at that as, listen, he's elevated the program, and as big jobs open, he should 100% be in consideration for those, so credit to him. And the second point I wanted to make was what, Larkin? I'll pause there.
Hey, shout out Thomas Power, Colorado kid.
Thank you. I was going to say Creek. That.
You want a good lacrosse roster? It starts in Denver, Colorado, baby.
Also, to your point about Utah's goal differential, I just want to make it, like, on a season-long basis, they have a -9 goal differential, and they're 1-6. That's outrageous.
And again, 10 of those is in the loss to Syracuse.
Correct. Plus six is in the win over Ohio State.
Yeah. And final point, shout-out, Bishop Kelly Knights. I'm the assistant defensive coordinator there. Big win, state championship rematch. You know, the defense struggled a little bit in the first quarter, first half. Offense was struggling. But if your IQ grows as the game goes on, world's your oyster. 9-4, big win for the Knights.
I remember what my second point was. Can I make it quickly?
Of course. That's what we were filling for. That's what they call it in the biz.
I'd like to implore the Brown University Bears offensive team room to, like, take some pride in their product. There's good lacrosse players in that room. Aiden McLean's he's not good. He's great. He just has really hard matchups every week. So to the midfielders who draw short sticks, and to some of those young attackmen, like, we can score more than 8 goals. I know it. And we're getting good enough goaltending and back-end help that we can clip a couple Ivy League wins. And ultimately, like, you only get 4 years in college. I don't believe in this notion of, like, a rebuild and long-term kind of growth trajectory. Like, let's go win right now. Like, there's a lot of people who care about this thing, and the Ivy is very gettable. So let's go, boys. I can't watch it.
That is a great note to end on. Let's go win the day, fellas.
Let's go.
Let's do it. More. Go Lady Cardinal.
Go Stanford. Beat Yale. Let's roll.
Beat Yale. Love you, Larkin.
See you, boys.
Love you, I said. He didn't say it back.
Yeah, he didn't say it back. Love you, Nick.
Unbelievable.